Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So yeah, welcome to 2023, the new this Gregorian year, having come in, and the new year that I mostly observe is the Chinese one, which is happening in a few weeks on the 22nd. We'll move into the year of the water rabbit, which I'm very excited about. But and the Buddhist New Year is another date entirely. And so here we are, in somewhere in the middle of the long string of New Years, but this is the one that sells a lot of calendars, and that you know, the numbers change. So here we are in 2023, and you know, it's New Year's resolution time. I was listening recently to a talk by some of my beloved teachers, Kitty Sarro and Tanisara, about aspects of the path dealing with vow, with this quality of making resolve or resolution or determination that has a kind of sacred force or power to it. And so I want to talk a little bit about vow power, a little bit about making resolutions, and a bit about a couple of qualities that are helpful to us as we look at the future, you know, in moments like this. The word for resolve in Pali is adhitana, and it is often translated, it's translated either as resolve or persistence or determination. So there's a quality in it of, you know, This is the quality that helps you stick with things, establish a course and stay with it, have the energy to stay with something. It's often a good pair with patience, kanti, and in a certain way with energy or virya. And these are, and all three of these are what's called paramis or perfections of the heart or heart mind. So, you know, we bring energy to our practice, to our unfolding life. Energy is really thought of as energy to cultivate the wholesome. So, you know, this whole realm of intention or vow or resolve is really held by the core practice in the Eightfold Path of right effort. So this is right or wise effort, samma vayama, and it is the bringing our attention to bear on the cultivating of wholesome states, so sustaining wholesome states, healthy states of body, heart, mind, when they have arisen, and cultivating them or drawing them in when they're not present. So some of the classic lists of those states are like the five powers, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, or the seven awakening factors, mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, there's virya, again, rapture, tranquility, immersion, and equanimity. So arousing factors, calming factors. So bringing in these, and the paramis themselves, you know, bringing in wholesome qualities and cultivating them, and then the counterpoint or the, you know, balancing factor to that within wise effort is the diminishing of unwholesome factors when they're present and the preventing of them when they're not present. So, you know, the classic list of the hindrances, sensual desire, and hatred or ill will, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, and doubt. These qualities that energetically, somatically, cognitively, physically, make it difficult to stay on the path in the way that we want. The defilements themselves, greed, hatred, and delusion, the great poisons. All of these, when we find them present or their symptoms present, there's, you know, the work of applying antidotes, shifting attention, making awareness more spacious or more focused as needed, to diminish the power of these unwholesome states and prevent them when they're not present. And so we bring energy to bear on that process, virya. We invoke the quality of patience, kanti, which is also translated forbearance. And with forbearance, which is a beautiful kind of antique word, pointing to, I think, a really helpful quality. It's patience, not just in the sense of, you know, I'm willing to wait for that which I want to arise, but I'm actually, forbearance is like I'm willing to endure discomfort or to endure that which is hard to bear, supported by the knowledge that what I'm cultivating is greater than the momentary fluctuation of pleasant and unpleasant experience. And so I learn to bear that which is difficult because I have a greater aim. And often that aim is in line with the First Noble Truth, to understand dukkha. So remembering that the definition of dukkha or suffering or unsatisfactoriness is, all of these aspects of experience that we get tangled in, that we get attached around, where grasping coalesces around getting what we want, preventing that which we don't want, the somatic challenges of birth, aging, sickness, and death, the life of pain and disappointment that is just an inevitable part of existence. The instruction for this First Noble Truth is to understand it. Dukkha is to be understood. But to understand dukkha, we have to get in touch with it. We have to get close to it. So there is, in wise effort, this balance of like, yes, I'm, you know, diminishing unwholesome states and preventing them as best I can. But also, when there's dukkha, when there's the painful state of grasping, yes, it's a hindrance to diminish, but it's also core dukkha to be understood. So there is a way that, you know, diminish the hindrance doesn't mean, you know, just do whatever you can to push them away. That's not going to work, right? You have to actually be in a balanced relationship with the painful in order to understand it and repattern the system to do things differently. So kanti, patience or forbearance, is one of the perfections needed to be able to do this. I actually have to be able to sit with the discomfort of boredom or uncertainty or anxiety or fear for the future or worry, and to really investigate what is anxiety actually? What's going on? What is it? You know, there's a bodily component that's maybe activated in different ways. There's an emotional component that's stirred up and activated. There's a story that's taking over the airwaves in a way, and is more believable than it needs to be, you know, is being given more floor time than it deserves. And so with forbearance, we are able to, you know, bear discomfort long enough to stop complaining about it, essentially, and be with reality. Like, oh, well, this is reality. This is what it is. And then resolve. Resolve kind of sits on top of, I think, you know, these basic qualities of energy and forbearance or patience. Resolve is not just about bearing what happens to have arisen in the present, but really, you know, draws on energy to make a path for the future. I resolve to give rise to certain actions in the future. And so resolve has this vow quality or vow power to it. In writing about this today, I was reflecting on, you know, why is there such a thing about like how you make New Year's resolutions and then you break them in the next few weeks. It's so much a thing that we would like, we would plan. When I worked at yoga studios for years, you know, we would plan to have a big bump in enrollment in January, and we would plan for that bump to die off by the third week of January. In other words, we would plan for everybody to come back to class the first couple weeks of the year with their brand new sparkling New Year's resolutions to do more yoga, and by the end of the month to just fall back into their old patterns. We have, there's dry January where you take a month off drinking because you've been drinking too much through the holidays. If stopping drinking is so healthy that it's an awesome thing to do dry January, then why not just stop entirely? You know, because it's hard to do. And we don't like doing things that are hard to do, many of us. And so I was thinking about like, why do resolutions fall apart so easily? My own resolution to exercise more regularly. It's like I have reasons for why it falls apart. I get busy, other things seem more important. But that's the thing, is that like, okay, well then the reason that it falls apart is that my resolve, my adhitana, my determination to do it is relatively weak, actually. Like, it's a good idea. I wish I had more of it. There's lots of other good ideas, like, that seem very important in the moment, like getting more caught up or meeting a deadline at work or, whatever it is, right? The weakness of the resolution is the Buddhist technical word would be the proximate cause, the most nearby condition for the thing to arise, right? That's the thing that I can feel that is most immediately connected, right? Like, I can't completely blame it on, my work schedule. Whenever I do, I remember that, President Obama would be down in the White House gym every single morning at 6 and never missed a morning, even when, nut jobs in other countries were saber rattling at us and people were mad at him. And it's like, well, you have a very stressful job, dude. People are always mad at you and trying to start wars on your watch and stuff. And, you go to the gym every morning. Like, I respect that. One of my friends, online was commenting around one of the recent posts and was talking about seeing her mom and grandmother doing their practice, meditating, doing mantra with mala beads each morning, no matter how chaotic the family situation was. So no matter what was going on in the family drama or in the story, there was mom and grandma doing their practice every single morning. And that was a remarkable anchor, a grounding, like a pillar around which the family system revolved. And so that's really the difference between, a resolution that has a kind of lightweight energy behind it and something that has like vow power. What are the things that you do like really no matter what, and classically, these things are not so much like practice rhythm kinds of things, like I will meditate every day no matter what. Like, that's a lovely resolution, and because it has to do with external things like your schedule and the space that you live in and the health of your body and things like that, it's hard to keep those kinds of resolutions, or the like, I will go to yoga, you know, every week now. Like, that depends on so many things, some of which are external to you. So I'm not trying to say, like, make your vow and it's something like, I want to meditate all the time or go to yoga a lot or do whatever thing that I want to do, and that you should be inflexible or rigid in that. That's not the sermon I want to give, so that's, don't take that away. But it's more like that there's a power that can come when the resolution is, it's almost like when the resolution is the appropriate resolution for you, this moment in your life right now. Like, there's a resolve that I can make. It's the right resolve that's really going to turn my path in the right direction or keep it going in the right direction. And it's not frivolous. It's not like, oh, I think this would be kind of a good thing. It's like, no, I need to do this. And I'm going to do it because I'm passionately convinced that it's important. And it's probably going to be more of an internal orientation. And so some of the traditional, you know, resolves are things more on the order of ethical practice. Like, I'm really going to keep the precepts. I'm going to renew the precepts every week. I'm going to be, you know, more rigorous in, you know, wise speech, for instance. Like, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to, like, exaggerate or diminish or beat around the bush or try to slip out of discomfort by warping my words in some way to make things more comfortable. I'm going to try to be really clear in my speech. I'm going to say, at times I've made the resolve that I'm really done with sarcasm as a kind of harsh speech. That just hurts my heart. I don't like it. And every once in a while it slips out because I'm a Gen Xer and I can't help it. That's no excuse, but that's my excuse. And it hurts. I don't like it. And so it's that kind of thing. And, you know, you might think of, again, to go back to the Eightfold Path, you know, the second limb of wise intentions, Sammāsaṅkappa. You know, the wise intention is like, you know, the intention toward harmlessness, the intention toward, you know, renunciation, right? Toward letting go of that which I don't need. That's a kind of vow that you can really, you know, lean into. And some of the vows that I think can be really most uplifting. The thing about a vow, you know, is that it's okay if you, like, you come up with some great noble vow or resolution, you know, determination, and it's hard to keep, you know. And maybe for you it might be something like, you know, I really feel like I'm done drinking, or a friend of mine recently was, you know, after like 30 years, really done smoking, you know, since teenage years, and you know, finally they're like, you know what, enough, you know. And so, like, make it can be like that. Sometimes you can make it be both more vast in a way, or broad, and more in the heart in a way that could be something like, you know, like, my being on the path of liberation, I'm ready for that to be, like, front and center in my life. You know, I'm ready to be devoted to liberation, you know, with my whole being. And the resolution is not that I want to be devoted to liberation with my whole being. It's almost that I recognize that I already am. And I want to give that already present vow or already present feeling the, you know, the power of vow. And so when something becomes a vow, or it has vow power, it's like you realize that you're ready to lean into being a certain way, like, for good. And I sort of mean that as a double entendre. Like, for good meaning, like, like this is not something that's going to drop or falter easily. It's going to be hard to get you to break this, but also it's for goodness. You know, it's for the uplifting of the good. And so, in this sense, it's really a support. It's a protection for the heart. You know, which is why they're so often, you know, ethically based. So related to this, then. So here, that's my encouragement to make a great, you know, strong adhidhana, strong vow or determination, to support your practice and to support your well-being in whatever channel. But one of the classic supports for this, and this partly came from a question that arose out of last week's talk. I posted this sutta on 8 ways to develop wisdom. And they are things like hang out with wise people, not foolish people, hang out with good teachers, all of that. And one of the guidelines is that with good teachers, one should cultivate these two qualities. And they always come as a pair, and they have a kind of scary name. So the Pali terms are hiri and otapa, and the old kind of slightly frightening translation is moral shame and moral dread. And a translation that I somewhat prefer is Bhikkhu Sujato's translation, conscience and prudence, which are also nice, slightly antique words. But in a way, most of the words we use for ethical action are sound fairly antique. And I think that says something about who we are as moderns, that all of our words for being good people in the world sound kind of old fashioned. Because I think being a good person in the world sounds kind of old fashioned, even though, like, what up with that? Shame and dread. I partly like using the old terms, moral shame and moral dread, because I want to rescue both of those terms, but particularly shame, from its perch as the sort of, you know, reviled internal state of those who want to feel empowered and, you know, self-assured, that one should defeat shame in some way. And you know, maybe really they should just be two different words, because I understand psychologically that there's aspects of shame where it's a kind of self-hatred, really, that is quite unhealthy. So don't do that. Easier said than done, but there you go. Don't do that. But moral shame is, or conscience, is the heartfelt reflection on one's own past and on one's actions in the past, in relation to their ethical basis. So it's really a deep, healthy remorse for unskillful actions done in the past. And you can include in it the positive. There can be definitely an appreciation for the wholesome actions one has done in the past. That's often actually a really strong support for self-metta. If you're having trouble giving loving kindness to yourself, think of some good things you've done, because you've undoubtedly done any number of really lovely, kind, you know, helpful things in the world for others, if not for yourself. And so you can bring those to mind. So that would be the positive side of this. But the negative one, the moral shame one, is really to reflect on the past in an intentional way, and really feel remorse, sadness, grief even, over one's own actions, my own actions in the past that have hurt others or myself. And so this is healthy to do. It's a beautiful reflection. It's a lovely reflection to do at New Year's. My landmates here were asking me, what are you going to teach on tonight? And I mentioned this. And they're all part of a kind of radical Jewish organization here. And so one of them said, oh, yeah, that's Yom Kippur. And I was like, yeah. So we're going to talk about that. So this isn't unique to the Buddha's teachings at all, but the way the Buddha spins it, it really has to do with what we could think of as a kind of purification of karma or of action. You know, often when we are in deep meditation, you know, or if we're on a retreat, or if our meditation, you know, actually in a given moment just really touches ourselves, it goes deep for a moment, we really rest into ourselves, often what can happen is a kind of life review, where we think about the past and things come to mind that want to be processed. And I think this is generally healthy. It can get obsessive, and then it's tips over into being repetitive distraction. But some amount of it is really healthy. And this is a practice to do when that either happens spontaneously, or you can do it on purpose. You could sit down for a meditation and, you know, bring, like, invoke in ritual space, you know, something with, and it has the kind of energy of, may the past be purified. And so I might bring up something that I did, you know, something that I said. You can remember the teachings on intention and impact here, and understand that you may think of something where you didn't have the intent to cause harm, but harm was caused by your actions or your words. And you can bring that up and sincerely feel sorry for that, you know, and you can, you know, feel the grief of having caused harm. And so this is hiri, this is conscience, really, you know, reflecting on the past. And the result of this, if we do it well and fully, is that the kind of obsessive regret and chewing over the past that we can get caught in doesn't happen so much. Like, really, this is a form of emotional process, you know, for your own past. But these things that I worry so much about, like that, what I did, the result of this really is to understand that, like, I've brought into the space of loving witness my own actions based in, you know, delusion, based in any of the hindrances that were up for me at the time. And I see it, and I know that I have work to do, and I feel sorry for it, and I have compassion for myself and for others, and this is, you know. And then when I'm finished with the reflection, you know, you set it down. Set it down, and you just come back to loving kindness, come back to the breath. So hiri, moral shame or conscience, points toward the past. It's that kind of reflection. And then moral dread, otapa, or prudence, I like the word prudence, dear prudence, comes in around the future. And it's the same quality spun into a kind of vow that, and, you know, prudence is a little bit mellow, you know, I want to be prudent, yes, but I kind of like dread, to be honest, because it's considered wholesome. I think this is wholesome in the same way that fear of God in the Christian tradition would be considered wholesome, that it's actually wholesome to look at the future, to know what happens when unwholesome action is committed, right? Both of these, they have a wisdom quality, because you are looping in your understanding of conditionality. Like, well, when actions are, you know, fueled by delusion or their hindrances, they often cause harm, and you can see how that works. This kind of words leads to this kind of result. These kind of actions lead to this kind of result. And seeing how that works can give rise to a very strong desire not to cause harm, right? And this is wholesome. So it's really a dread of committing unwholesome action in the future and causing harm. So prudence or moral dread has this quality of, you know, vowing to keep the precepts more strongly, more vigorously, more subtly in our life. And, you know, doing so knits, it makes, you know, then this moment that we're in right now has this kind of shimmering quality, because attention gathers or coalesces in these reflections, and it becomes like, oh, I've knit together the messy past with the appropriate qualities of, you know, of remorse and forgiveness and grief and celebration of the good and letting go, all of those that are appropriate for the past. I've knit those together where that informs the future, and it becomes this desire to manifest the wholesome qualities, to manifest generosity and kindness and right speech, and to keep the precepts and to serve others and to develop the good qualities. And between those two, the mind state in the present can be, just luminous with the underlying intent, which is toward well-being, for myself and others. We know that when we act in ways that are conducive to well-being, our own well-being blooms, because our own well-being is so, the main thing that diminishes our well-being is fear, worry, angst, all of those things. External conditions matter, but people can be in dire external conditions and have a lovely state of mind. It's totally possible, right? People can be in fabulous external conditions and have a terrible state of mind. Totally possible, And so the Buddha, focuses the paramis, the perfections, the cultivation of the heart, really on what are the conditions for the heart to be well, no matter the external circumstances, because that is, the external is what's most out of our hands. So, the power then of Hiri and Otapa is that they're considered two bright things or bright qualities. The Pali word is Sukha Dhamma. They are happy dhammas, or they are things that conduce to ease, and they're also called the guardians of the world, right? They protect us from our own errors, really. And so the more we invoke them and let them be the underlying energy in our practice of resolve, of wise intention, of vow, they really mature into what I think all of the ethical limbs of practice are pointing toward, which is a kind of dignity moment to moment as I walk through the world. If these things are present with me, I'm less, and I'm passionate about them, to go back to that quality of vow, I'm passionate about them. They light up when the mind wanders into unwholesome territory, or my actions start to be triggered by, difficult conditions out in the world, and I start to waver, and, words or deeds are going to come out that, start to be in a direction that's not really going to be helpful. These qualities come in and say, oh, be careful for your own good and the good of others. And then you notice and you back off from the edge, and there's just the sense of like being held in more safety, for your own heart space and for those around us. So in praise of Hiri and Otapa, guardians on the path, and the power of really passionately pointing ourselves toward well-being, the energy of the vow and of wise determination supporting that.